I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, welcome to episode 2 of Marek Makes a Movie, the film podcast where I, Marek Larwood, go and speak to different filmmakers about how they made their own feature film with a view to making my own feature film. How am I going to do that? Well, you can find out all about it on my website. Go to MarekLarwood.com/Marek Makes a Movie or just click on the link there. So about 2 weeks in, and I've raised, thanks to you kind donators, 160 whole pounds. And thank you very much to anyone who's donated via the website. It is very pleasing. If you do donate £5 or more, I will send you a badge with a logo on it and a letter in the post, which will be worth millions of pounds when this film wins 3 to 4 Razzies. At the moment, I'm in the process of writing the first draft of the film. It's a horrible experience for everyone involved, i.e. me. You can find out more by going to the website, also the Facebook page, Marek Makes a Movie, the Twitter page, or also Instagram. That is a lot of admin. Even I'm bored. I'm bored already of my voice. And this is probably about 2 minutes in. I need to make it more exciting. Luckily, I am now going to speak to Bruce Webb, a man who has made his own feature film, as well as directing lots of other television programmes and films, and producing things, and all that business. He knows a lot more than I do, which is probably what could be said for most, you know, pedestrians. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the podcast and keep it real. Marek makes a movie. He talks to different filmmakers. He learns lots of things to put in his film. It's not that type of movie. It's probably the wrong music, it's giving you the wrong idea. It's just as a normal film, alright? It's not anything, it's not dirty stuff, it's just a, just listen to the podcast, alright? So here I am in Bruce's kitchen in, what, Elephant and Castle area. I can't reveal where you, I won't reveal where you live exactly, Bruce.
No, don't.
Are you in trouble with anyone? Is anyone looking for you?
No, actually, disappointingly, no one's really looking for me. So in fact, I'd like you to reveal the location so that some people did go looking for me.
So if that's not going to be incriminating there, if I say Elephant Castle.
No, I am. I do exist in Elephant Castle, but and another location which I think you know about.
Bruce lives in London and on the Isle of Wight, so we're friends through Paul Allen, who's on the first podcast, and Bruce. He's a director, filmmaker, producer. You've done all the business, haven't you, Bruce?
Yeah. I haven't mastered any of them, but I keep on changing jobs until hopefully one day I actually get good at one of them. Yeah.
But you have to do everything these days.
Well, I was an electrician. Started as an electrician, actually.
Really?
In the film business, yeah. And then I was a spark on a feature film in 1992, one with Christopher Lee called The Funny Man. And then I was in the art department for a bit. I had a job... wiring up tit lamps in a strip club scene.
Hang on.
Can
you explain tit lamps?
It's a film by a filmmaker called Simon Sprackling, called The Funny Man, which was this horror comedy, very violent horror comedy with Christopher Lee, which inspired me to go into the film business. I a friend of mine had very sadly been killed, run over by a petrol tanker on his bicycle. He was a good friend of mine from school, and I didn't know what to do that summer. I was at a bit of a loss. I was very in really bad grief. And a friend of mine said, "Why don't you come and work on this film for free?" So I went. I went on this film. It was in a. It was an old mental hospital, and I worked there for free on the short they did first of all, and then on the feature. And I think I was employed as an electrician. Yeah. So and one of the scenes was in a strip club called Club Sexy.
Good
and
name,
and
good
all of the lamps were all the lights in the strip club were women's breasts. They were plastic false boobs that they.
Oh.
So we had to. So we. And I've always been fascinated by electricity ever since I was a small child, which has been quite dangerous for all our pets. But I was quite good at wiring things. So they gave me the job of wiring all the tit lamps.
I thought it was a special lamp that was used to be pointing at the stripper's breasts so they were accentuated.
Like a Fresnel or something.
Is that what it's called, a Fresnel?
Fresnel. No, well, yeah. There's some great words in lighting. There's like gobos. That's quite a good word.
I've heard of gobos. I haven't heard of Fresnel before.
There's blondes. There's redheads.
Yeah, blondes. What are blondes?
I can never get it right. I think a blonde is a 2K and a redhead is an 800, I think.
That the K is the Kelvin, which is the strength.
Three amps to a K, I think it used to be. It's been so long since I've done sparking. Though I did line produce a feature film a few years ago where the gaffer constantly couldn't get out of bed, and I did find myself the old magic coming back again.
It's really difficult, isn't it? Even doing a 3-point lighting, it's difficult.
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah, yeah.
You don't realise it when you're in. That's the difference normally between lighting. So sound and lighting are more important than people bang on about what camera you get and what the quality of the camera. But if something's not lit properly or the sound's crap, it's.
I think it's weirdly enough a college I teach at. The cinematography students, they take them to the Tate Britain, and show them old masters as part of their training to show them how light falls on subjects. And I think when you go to an art gallery and you look at the way light falls on subjects, then you. And because it's obviously not a photograph, so it's someone's interpretation, then you have a better understanding of how to light a subject in a film.
So become a painter first.
Become a painter first.
A couple of masterpieces. And then get a job as a spark on a film set.
Incidentally, I do know a filmmaker who went to Slade Art School, and he sells his art to pay for his shorts. And he always gets BAFTAs. You should interview him. I can remember his name. Even though he's a friend.
We'll remember his name. I watched your film last night, which is there's a poster of it on the wall behind.
Okay.
The Be All and End All.
He's cleaning this.
I really loved it. Well done.
Thank you. Thanks. I'm quite proud of it, really.
It feels completely different to anything that gets released now. Basically, it's a story of two Liverpudlian friends.
Yeah.
And one of them finds out he has a heart disease, and then which is sort of terminal, and he wants his friend to help him lose his virginity before he dies. But the problem is he's hospital bound. Is that a fair description of
that? That's a very fair description, yeah. I'd like to point out that there were lots of films made after it of the same theme, but we did make the first one. So there's things like, I think there was a 50-50, I think it was made. Then there was short film that was made that won a short Oscar. I think these days when people see it, they think, oh, I've heard of this film before. But actually, it was quite original when we made it. It's 10 years old, though. It's 10 years almost to the day that
And you shot that on film, did you?
Shot on Super 16, yeah. And probably one of the last Super 16 feature films. Certainly was. The companies that made it are no longer with us, unfortunately. And certainly the labs... The lab, even the film supplier Fuji doesn't supply feature film anymore. It does have a quite an old fashioned look to it, and it's funny you said it's not the sort of film that get released anymore. But I think in a good way
that I felt quite refreshed by it. I used to like I really loved the Friday film special that were on in the 80s because it felt like this is a film. I can watch as a young person that appeals to me, and it felt quite nostalgic as well, like that youthful thing, and the actors were so unpolished and quite. I really like that.
Yeah,
and one really makes films for this market anymore. It felt like.
I think in the UK, and I don't want to go party politics on it, but there was a deliberate move by the government when they got rid of the Film Council in the UK. To only support films that were going to make money. In fact, David Cameron actually said that publicly. So the reason why you're not seeing these films anymore is because they're not being made. And there's lots of other things involved, apart from just politics and getting rid of the Film Council and getting rid of the regions. There's also DVD sales, obviously. We used to make, between £5 and £10 net on a DVD. That's just gone. That's completely disappeared, that market. You can't buy a DVD anywhere apart from the supermarket.
How can I watch this film?
You can buy you can buy a DVD anywhere. You can buy a DVD of this online. You can watch it on iTunes. You can watch it on Amazon.
Okay.
You can watch it. You know, online. But the profit, you know, the percentage we get is maybe 10 or 20p on a download, whereas we were talking £7 or £8 on a DVD many years, not that long ago. And so you must remember the Danny Dyer period of what will be known in history as the Danny Dyer hooligan period, which is now gone. You know, I mean, because if you sold 100,000 DVDs, you can make a million, and now you can't do that. So, but one thing I would say is that those sort of children's films like this teenage film, because I made another film a few years back called Social Suicide, which is also a teen movie. They're being made all over Europe, but we don't watch them in the UK. We don't do live action for kids anymore, and I think actually we're. Statistically, again, we're losing a generation of filmgoers.
I mean, it's crazy because Friday Film Specials got me into films, and that would be the perfect thing to go to young filmmakers, make a low budget film, because that BBC, it's all CBeebies now, isn't it? Because BBC's not, it's some prick going around some antique shop and buying something. That's all it is. I mean, mind you, I am a big fan of Antiques Roadshow.
Oh, mate, I mean, that's I have a little routine, Antiques Roadshow, followed by Chasing Classic Cars on Quest, followed by The Simpsons, followed by Channel 4 News. I think that's my evening.
I mean, that's probably a good thing, but they should bring back Friday Film Specials. Now,
I agree.
I want to talk about, because obviously listeners are really intrigued by the subplot of me making my film, which is not going to be called Barry Needs a Piss. That was the...
okay, good.
That was just an example.
I was worried about how you'd market that, yeah.
Well, it's a universal subject.
Yeah. Well, no, I just didn't know whether legally you could have a post that said piss on it in public.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because I'm writing something at the moment, another script, and the title of that...
Might be Barry Needs a Wee, maybe.
Yeah, not the same, is it?
No, it isn't really.
A wee is... An adult saying need a wee, you think, oh, it's a sex offender.
Yeah. Yeah. Funny enough, I think my dad says that quite
often. Well, you say in polite company, don't you? But you
well, you shouldn't actually say anything. You shouldn't go into any details.
You just go to the toilet. Where's the toilet, please?
Yeah. But I do think the other day, when someone says, I'm just off to the toilet, it does imply they're doing a number two. Whereas if they're off, they're saying they're going for a piss.
Yeah.
If you say, I'm going for a piss, then it actually, then you know what they're doing. So, yeah, we should not identify any specifics, really.
Yeah,
maybe go the American way and saying, I make a visit to the bathroom.
But if you do, the politer you are, you're right, the more it sounds like you're having a shit.
Yeah.
By not saying you need a wee, people were...
Yeah.
I mean, that will probably be a more interesting podcast. What is the best way to talk about going to the toilet in different scenarios?
Yeah.
Is there one sentence that could apply to all of them? Well, I mean, that's
another day.
So what was your experience... like on this, did you get employed as a director, or were you involved with the whole?
No, so I'd done. What had happened was I'd been a producer for many years, and I produced about 40-50 shorts, and a very bad feature film I produced when I was in Nottingham at university, and then I got really really frustrated making other people's films. So I was very frustrated watching directors have all this success or failing, and thought, you know, when I was 35, I thought. I'm going to go and direct a film. I'm going to give this a go. So I met a woman called Wendy Bevan-Mogg, who had written a adaptation of a short film. Then they introduced me to a man called Mike Woodward, who was an exec producer on this feature film as well. And we managed to get... It was the bizarre situation. I was on a yacht in Cannes, which doesn't sound cliched enough, and we managed to get 20 grand for a short film.
Oh, great.
So... So I made that short film, and off the back of that, I became inspired.
Did he hand you in a sort of leather brief? What's it called, attaché?
No, it wasn't. It was better than that. It was wired almost within a week, straight into an account. So yeah, and that was a very lovely man that backed that film, actually. And joking aside, but anyway, so we then, as a company, I used to have a company with my best mate Alex Lewis, who now works in film accountancy. We had this company called Whatever Pictures, where we'd made all these films, and we went on search for scripts. And I think we got about 100 scripts in. We had various different people working for us reading scripts. Several people claim to have found that script over time. I don't know actually who did in the end, but Alex recommended it to me, said, I think you should read this script, and it was brilliant. You know, it was really, really well written by a guy who's an editor called Steve and a fireman called Tony. And it was based on a story they had heard in Australia. And the thing I loved about it was it was moving and it was funny. And I think what the Irish are doing at the moment in Irish cinema is exactly that. They're making knowing and clever but very funny films. So they're always about a subject matter. If you get a film like Date for Mount Mary or Sing Street, mm-hmm. they actually have a serious undertone to them. And this is a comedy about a kid dying of heart disease. You know, I spent many hours in Great Ormond Street talking to nurses there. We talked to children that had cardiomyopathy who have since passed away. So we did take it very, very seriously. But yeah, so that's what appealed to me basically. So that's I wasn't a gun for hire. On the last film I did, I was a gun for hire. I was a director who'd been paid. It was like a TV movie really, because the speed of the development and shooting process was so quick.
Yeah.
It was more like working on a TV drama, really. This took years. This was 5 years in the making, I think.
5 years, blimey.
From getting the script to the last sales at film festivals, yeah. And I was producing it all the way along, apart from when I was on set and I had a co-producer.
So by producing, you mean were you in charge of raising all the funds and stuff like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, so me and a great guy called Mike Woodward, lovely man. He was the director of Barclays Wealth Bank. He was the man I met on the yacht. He approached some more of his clients and said, look, I've got this film idea. And I had to pitch at a lunch of what was known as high net worth individuals. So people with lots of money. A few of them backed it. Yeah.
Great.
Including David Morrissey, you know, the actor David Morrissey, his brother Paul Morrissey. Yeah. So his brother Paul Morrissey put in in-kind support, so a very large of in-kind support, which included hotel rooms and cars and all the rest of it.
Can you say what the budget was, or is it top secret?
It's not top secret, really. No, I mean, I think the distributor would hate me to say, but it was the final budget was £168,000.
That's quite low. I thought it'd be more than that
for Super 16. Yeah, it certainly was, and I can even tell you how it was set up, that money, because it was £150,000. SEIS scheme, so it was a senior enterprise investment scheme, so it had a tax credit, a tax break attached to it, so the investors didn't risk very much, and then we got the UK tax credit, which is roughly about 20%.
Okay.
So we used tax incentives to make it, but I mean, there's a couple of films I've made since, like Nina Forever, which is a film Align produced, and Breakfast with Johnny Wilkins. So they used the SEIS. Well, I think the budget of films is dropping even more now. I mean, I think your budget.
Well, I've got £160 so far.
I think £160 could be actually a world-breaking record.
Well, I'm not going to start. I've got more than that. I'm more a micro. I've been listening to lots of micro-budget film. I mean, it's basically you just pay whether you pay your crew or not, or how much you can pay people.
I know this is supposed to be light-hearted, this this podcast, but on a serious note, you don't want to end up being done by the HMRC for not paying the minimum wage. And also, the two bottom lines are, you don't want to go to prison for not paying people the right amount, and you don't want to hurt anyone on set. And I think you've got to look after your crew, and so you have a legal obligation, obviously, and a moral obligation, not to kill any members of your crew or maim any of them. And joking aside, that does happen on set. So really, you can make something for nothing, but you're going to have to be careful about how you go about it. And really, without sounding cynical, the bottom line is you've got to get your crew to sign away their rights.
Yeah.
In that way. But yeah, 100. I mean, I'm sure it's doable. £160.
I'll have more than that. I'll have more than that, bros. Don't worry.
I think Planet of the Apes was £350,000 a day. I think their budget.
Wow.
Yeah, £35,000 an hour.
It's different now because shooting on digital as opposed to on film. I mean, you must have shot your stuff recently.
Yeah, we shot on an Alexa. Well, I'd love to always shoot on film because the texture of 35mm is amazing. But I think weirdly enough, I'm a bit obsessed by Canon C500s and C300s. I think they have more of a film look than the Alexa for some bizarre reason. I think they have a softer, more contrasty look. And the Alexa, actually, I find a little bit. I don't know. It's the way it's used, isn't it? But I mean, a friend of mine recently did a million and a bit film on a C300. with very expensive lenses, but it looks absolutely amazing.
But two of my favourite films, Blue Ruin, which is basically a low budget film by the bloke who went on to make Green Room, and they bought a C300 because they thought it was cheaper to buy it their credit card, so they spent, it must have been about 10 grand, I think.
Yeah.
And then shot that on that, and Blue is the Warmest Colour shot on C300s as well.
Is it? Yeah. Well, so Blue the Sea, that's an enormous film in terms of its success.
Yeah. But I think they were shooting so much in people's faces. They need something quite... In terms of people, for people who don't know, basically the hierarchy of cameras, which you work in TVs, Alexa's the sort of all red, which are these really expensive cameras made by some weirdo, but they're more... They have things like Transformers or action films seem to use red.
The Phantom's at the very top, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you want to be really nerdy.
That's the one that shoots at, a million frames a second or something like that. And then people use the Canon C300s or now Sony's FS7s. I'm seeing a lot of those in use. And then right down to really low budget stuff's just DSLRs, like the 5D really changed, didn't the Canon 5D?
Yeah, well. I mean, I'm going to completely contradict myself here, but because I've just done exactly what I'm about to criticise, but I do get a lot of people saying to me, especially students.
So look, I should say that you as well now, you teach at a film school.
I teach at various film schools, yeah. So I lecture at various, so I teach directing and producing.
Okay.
Various film schools, but yeah. So what does happen is you get a lot of students who say, "I've got this red camera," and you're like, "Great, what's the story?" And then they go, "Yeah, but I've got this red camera," and you're like, "Yeah, what's the story?" Mm. And they're like, "Well, we've got this great camera and we've got this slider," and you're like, "I couldn't care less, really. Actually, really, what you're going to shoot on? What's the story?" And I think a lot of people get obsessed about technology, and especially men, particularly, instead of actually thinking about the performance of the actors and the story. Is the story interesting? That's the bottom line, isn't it?
I think it's a film. I think our friend Paul's in the first episode showed me a film called The Puffy Chair, which is part of that mumblecore bunch of filmmakers, who these American filmmakers who made things for so low budget. And this was shot on a DV cam, which is just basically tapes, I think, before that came along, and not really lit properly. But the sound was all right, and the story and the characters were brilliant. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it went in and out of focus... After the first 5 minutes, it's like walking out into the dark. I think the first 5 minutes you're getting accustomed to it, and then you're in. Then if the story's got you,
absolutely. I mean, Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton are shot on a format that is probably 9.5 millimeter. I'm sure someone will correct us if we're wrong, but it was a format that's even worse than VHS. But that stuff's still worth millions in terms of its library. You know, it shouldn't be your format, really. I think the camera should be... The camera you use, like the sound equipment, should be lightweight and easy to move around, especially doing low budget, and be able to work at very, very low light, really. And that's what's changed so much, is that we now have equipment which can go in very, very low light.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
batteries last a very long time. And having read various different interviews recently with people quite high up in the lighting world, including the guy who designed the KinoFlow, we're looking more and more at just using practical lighting. So the old days of huge, you know, teams of sparks and big lights, you know, big 10K HMIs all over the place trying to replicate daylight. We will still need those key lights to go through windows, but I think when we're doing interior scenes, we can just use practical lighting. We don't have to use... And now they're designing light bulbs that can be dimmed. They're actually designing light bulbs that can direct light in a certain angle. Mm. So, and this all actually just drives costs down. So even though we're going through this period of time where it actually is a bit of doom and gloom for independent film, in this country particularly, we are, on the other hand, getting this changing technology, and the digitization, we're going into this new industrial revolution. That is actually driving costs down. So it is quite an exciting time. I think once we've got we can go on to distribution a little bit later if you want, but once we get the distribution models working, like Spotify, you know, because we're in this strange transition period at the moment where, like, you know, iTunes, do you ever watch a film on iTunes and it will work very well? And how do you find, you know, lots of people say, I can't find this film online. And so they go to piracy because they can't actually find it. I think once we sort out the distribution models and we're able to distribute our own films, then we're suddenly looking at, you know, for 10 grand, you can, in terms of equipment, you can go out and make your own film and distribute it to a global market. That is really exciting.
I don't know why YouTube used to be able to sell your stuff if you had over 1,000 users, and they took it off now.
Mm-hmm.
Which is crazy, because you think YouTube would be the perfect thing for flogging your film on there.
Well, Vimeo certainly does that, now these days you have to use an aggregator. In fact, there's a talk on later on this month by an aggregator that I
can
use.
Can you explain what an aggregator is?
Aggregators also known by distributors as aggressors, I think, because in recent years the big sales agents and distributors in the UK, like Metrodome, and I think recently Fusion Sales, I think as well, have gone bust. They've gone under. So these The way the model works is the cinema takes 70% of your revenue.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a film at the cinema, or between 50 and 70. Your distributor then takes 50% of your sales, and then your sales agents takes 20%. That leaves you, like, hardly anything left. So mm-hmm. filmmakers have never made money. Lots of people around filmmakers have made money. And so these guys are going out of business, which is very sad for the people that have worked all their lives in that business, and some of them are good friends. And they're being replaced by something called an aggregator. And an aggregator is a company that can take your film and then they'll place it with Hulu, Google, Amazon Play, Google Play, Amazon, all those companies, Netflix, who else is there out there?
That's quite a lot of them, that's fine.
That lot.
Yeah.
They'll place them with those companies and they take a cut of revenue. So they're acting like a sales agent. Now, these guys have cornered the market because you can't get onto iTunes without going through an aggregator.
Okay.
But I've heard rumours, and whether they're true or not, I'm sure your listeners can try and find this out, that Amazon now is allowing you to upload your own films onto it.
There's a new thing they're trying to do, isn't there? I got an email from Amazon saying, they're trying to rival YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know enough about it, I need to look into it more.
So Someone like Amazon and someone like Netflix were worth nothing once because all they were shop windows.
Mm.
So any other shop window could have come along. And I think Amazon or Netflix particularly went, hang on, you know, we could be replaced by someone tomorrow. We need to make our own content. So Netflix decided, I mean, I think next year they're making 80 feature films. They're making like £7 billion worth of feature films and TV, which is killing off a large proportion of our industry in some ways. In some ways, it's really good for our industry because there's such high employment in the film business at the moment. But yeah, they're making their own content. And so these other guys, they're thinking, and girls, they're thinking, yeah, we need to make our own content as well, but we can't afford to make it. So what do? We get other people to make the content for us. The problem is you've got to wade through, you know, tons and tons of crap films to find the good ones. But yeah, the future is exciting. We're going to be able to make our own films. We're going to be able to distribute them, and we're going to be able to take all the cash ourselves. And what you'll end up doing when you distribute a film is you'll end up spending all the money on PR rather than having all the money taken away from you by a distributor or sales agent.
Mm. So things are getting better then. It sounds like you haven't enjoyed the whole film industry process and your experience of it.
I think Yeah, I don't know how you can tell that. I think I became a little bit obsessed, and I think we all do become a little bit obsessed about trying to make these sort of like amazing films. I got into the business because I wanted to be a documentary filmmaker and actually make films that change the world. And I was really into the Putman era, David Putman as a producer, who made amazing films like The Mission. Mm-hmm. And filmmakers like Ken Loach, who actually changed the world. You know, they actually changed the law in the same way that Blue Planet at the moment is changing the way we use plastic. And I think I got a little bit lost on the way, exactly what I was supposed to be doing in it. But I think what has been very hard for a lot of us recently is the way the film industry has changed so rapidly. It was, you know, within 5 years, I didn't recognise the film business. Film had gone, digital had come in. You know, very young people were making stuff that looked amazing with these really cheap cameras, and we have to adapt super, super quickly. I found it frustrating. Also, we are going through a period now where a lot of people have gone to prison for fraud and fiddling the tax credit. So investors in the city are not that keen to invest in films. So it's a tricky period of time. But the thing that keeps me positive is how cheaply we can make a film. The new film I'm writing at the moment, I think, can be made for well under 100 grand, and that's quite exciting, I think.
That's great. What's that about? Is it top secret still?
It is slightly top secret, just because it's a bit of a unique idea. But I will tell you one thing that I've done in designing the film is I was working on a show in Ireland with a great, great bunch of writers and crew, a show called Red Rock, which goes out on the BBC. It was a very low budget soap, and then it became a late night drama. One thing we're always being told by the producers is we had to stick with our parameters. Parameters in the film business, like on a soap opera, you can only do one day out on location, you can only have one driver, you can only have five extras. And so it means it's quite a challenge to shoot this sort of thing. And I thought, why not, as a line producer and a director, why don't I approach the writing process with the parameters in my head to say no more than 10 cast, no more than 10 day shooting, no more than 10 locations, no more than 10 crew. And so I've just come up with these parameters and put them on myself. And it makes it a challenge to write, but I know for a fact that it's going to be a hell of a lot easier to make. Because I'm not... And I've also... The other rule I'm trying to do is try and make as many of the locations exterior day, or city locations exterior night. And then we don't need a huge amount of lighting as well. So that's the idea behind
I mean, it's what you do with micro-budget films, as in my film... Trying to find a way of using three or four locations and keep on using those in the film and keep it interesting rather than looking at it's the same place over and over again.
What I see constantly is people saying, oh yeah, I've written a film in one room. And then and having just made a film that was pretty much in one room in a police cell, it is very, very hard to keep people interested in one room. It's also, having shot in police cells on a continuing drama, I know there's only so many ways you can film in a police cell. There literally is only so many, and lots of people think, I'm sure I could come up with a new way. You can't, you know. There's only so many angles you can do. So I think it's a mistake to try and set something just in one room, because what makes a film cinematic is landscapes and big vistas and drama and, you know. And, I've just seen some things fail that were set in one room. So I've tried to do the opposite of that with a script, and I've tried to set it all outside.
Yeah.
And London's an amazing... I mean, London is incredible, you know. It's like, what an amazing architectural feast we have in London. And we don't ever, as filmmakers, ever take advantage of it, I don't think. We don't... I mean, when you get Bollywood filmmakers come here, they always want to film in front of Buckingham Palace or in front of a red letterbox. You've got to think about your global audience, because British people don't really watch British films. But in Europe... in America and in the Commonwealth, they love British films and they love British culture and all the things that signify Britain. So we should probably take more advantage of that. I'm guilty of that as well.
Put some fish and chips in it.
Princess Diana. Yeah, like a dodgy politician, you know, a bit of racism, you know, all the real things that make us British.
Mr. Bean.
Yeah, Mr. Bean.
Picture Mr. Bean.
But actually, joking aside, Mr. Bean does take advantage of all that.
When I taught English as a foreign language before I started doing stand-up, I'd ask them to write down one lesson, you sort of churn out the same lessons over and over again.
Yeah.
What they thought, you know, their ideas of Britain and what famous people they like. And it literally would be Princess Diana, the Queen, Mr. Bean. That's the top.
Mr.
Top
Bean. Group. The Beatles weren't in there then.
Yeah, before, but then Mr. Bean was more famous than the Beatles.
Yeah, that's why he's so rich, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't it?
It's break time. Time to have a break. All the talking, it's too much. I just want to have a little bit of music in the middle to calm myself down. Now I'm ready to get back to the podcast.
So what's the questions you get asked most by your students?
Why are you depressing us so much with these statistics about the film business? We thought we were going to be millionaires, sir. The question I get asked so much, I don't know. There's no money, is it?
I mean, it's just an artistic...
Well, statistically, if you make a low-budget British film, you will not make any money. I think it was only 7% of British films made in the last 10 years made a pound at the box office. And something like 20% didn't even actually get to the cinema at all. So if you have a film released that you've made, you need a big pat on the back, you know. But I don't know what they asked me actually. I think they all want a magic formula. They all want to know, and I think a lot of students don't realise that it's actually extremely hard work that gets you success. You know, you could be extremely talented, but you still got to work very hard. And the film business is one of the hardest businesses to work in. You know, with the hours we do, and the lack of thanks we get for what we do. And there's a lot of narcissists in it as well. So you've got to wade through a lot of bullshit to find the real people in it. So,
I mean, that's why part of the reason I'm doing this is that when I've made stuff and I've done stuff on quite bigger sets, I always enjoy the small crew, the skeleton crew.
Mm-hmm, me too.
And yeah. I think there's something in that. If you've got a bit where the hope it is that you've got the script that works, but you've got that flexibility to try stuff. Mm. You tend to get more footage down if you've got more time to do it.
Yeah.
You haven't got people who... I mean, people... Well, you know, costumes and makeup are brilliant, but sometimes for low-budget films, all the times you have before each take of someone checking something, half the time you think, you don't need to check.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just people doing the jobs. And the time...
That's what I love. I love working with this Irish crew I've just been working with. They are just unbelievable. They work... I mean, we shot 21 pages on one day. And that's a really high-quality drama that goes out on prime time BBC. I mean, it wasn't... It was horrible. And then I nearly felt like I was going to die.
Was it a 12-hour day, though? Was it?
It was a 10-hour plus one, so it was an 11-hour day. But we were supposed to be averaging 10 to 15 hours pages a day or minutes per day. But they're exactly like that. They don't. What's the point in double checking everything 15 times? You know, if the audience is looking at that collar sticking up, then they're not watching the thing anyway.
Mm.
But also, I mean, there's a difference between TV and film. On film, you do have to check absolutely everything because it's going to be 100 foot wide on the wall, and you're going to see it all on a film. If you're making TV, then obviously, all right, you might have big TVs, but I'm not saying rush anything. I'm not saying you've got to be professional. But yeah, there's a lot of people that can fanny about. And I agree, that small crew, it's like going to war, isn't it? You become such good friends. And that ability to be able to improvise and experiment. And as long as there's no one precious, if you've got somebody who's really precious and takes their time, so much time to do something, it can be counterproductive to your creativity. And I'm with you, you know. I do have a slapdash attitude sometimes, which is one of my biggest faults. But yeah, you're better off getting on with it and doing it rather than not doing it at all.
Yeah. Yeah, in terms of performances, stuff you've done when it's relaxed and everyone's relaxed, it's quite small. You can sometimes get some magic which you can't really get when you're working with a big crew. There's no time to improvise, and there's no time. A lot of time they don't give you that space to do the extra takes if it's a lot of, you know, time is precious. And sometimes in performances, my experience is you just, the extra free one, the time to get a free take at the end and get them to try some, just, you know, just try it. That's when you get the stuff that's in.
Absolutely. And I think I know for a fact, having directed a lot of kids' TV and kids' comedy and two kids' films, is that teenagers particularly, you'll actually get their best work in the first or second take, because their performance will generally go downhill afterwards. But then if you let them muck about and try lots of different things, that you're right, that's when you can get the magic. And you know, adults are similar, you know. The thing I find when I'm directing, getting a good performance, is my concentration has to be absolutely, completely, 100% focused on that monitor and then my headphones on to be able to give an opinion on whether whether performance is good or not. You've got to, as a director, I think, go into your own zone and be absolutely focused on that person's performance and hypersensitive to the meaning of what they're saying and the emotion that their character's supposed to be giving. And I find it very hard, you know, if I'm a bit of a attention deficit disorder. I'm very fidgety, sort of like, and I find it hard to concentrate. But I'm sort of like, you know, practicing more and more of that sort of focus on a performance, and I love it. I really enjoy it. Trying to get a great performance out of someone is, and I think actors really enjoy it. They respond to it really well as well. You know, it's not all about the picture. It's not about moving the camera around. It's not all about that. It's about storytelling, about people in it, and that's why I say to my students, you know, at the end of the day, making a film's quite easy. You've got to shine a light on someone and get them to pretend to be someone else. Oh, then film it, and then you just project that on the wall. But you know, it's the storytelling and the writing and it's the other stuff which is actually harder. So we've got this amazing generation which can film anything because they've got all the equipment. But it's whether they can write the stories.
That's what I think. Watching stuff. Maybe it's me being nostalgic, but I do think sometimes when you look at the old TV programs, watching old Cagney and Lacey.
That's what I grew up with, writing on that was absolutely brilliant. That's what I grew up with: Cagney and Lacey, Magnum PI, Miami Vice, James Garner in the Rockford Files. Oh, yeah. And you were right. Each time there was brilliantly written, it was brilliant. Hill Street Blues, there was a great story, and that's what kept us focused. And it's that the great filmmakers are the ones who can tell a story, you know. I mean you see it so often on TV. I mean, I'm watching Spiral at the moment, which is a French police drama, and the writing on that is absolutely brilliant.
And the
performance is amazing. You know, I'm utterly convinced of these characters. You know, and it's not an easy thing to do. It really isn't.
Now, going back to the scripts and things, what is the traditional feature film length script? 90 pages.
Yeah, so we work generally on a piece of software called Final Draft, which mimics the old Warner Brothers or whatever it was script format, and that is a page a minute generally. It doesn't really work when you've got something like a Baby Driver or one of those films where Edgar Wright, because they're so quick.
Yeah,
I imagine the word count doesn't always quite add up. But yeah, we work on a page a minute, and a feature film, by its definition, through distributors, is normally a film over 60 minutes, and a short film is a film under 30 minutes. And then a television drama would be, you know, between 30 and 60.
What happens if your film is between 30 and 60? Screwed.
It's just a bit of a... No, you're not screwed. I think Shane Meadows made an hour-long film. Between 30 and 60, I don't know. It'd just be hard to sell, probably.
61 minutes, the dream.
61 minutes, yeah. I mean, there's some great 70-minute films out there. There's some really great 70-minute films. I mean, it's really bad. I haven't seen the new Blade Runner film because I saw the running time and I just thought, I don't know if I can sit there for that long. I will see it, of course. But yeah, you've got. I think if you're going to do low, but there's some really good rules I have for you.
Yeah, what? Tell me the rules.
Making a low budget film, do not try and do anything that Hollywood can do, because you'll do it shitter than they do it. So basically,
CGI snakes.
And it's really interesting when you look at the statistics on what makes money as well. The highest grossing films for the lowest amount of money are faith films, so films about God,
mm-hmm.
and horror films. Okay, horror films don't need famous people in, and faith films have a market, they're going to buy it. So the rules are, don't make anything that Hollywood could make. So don't make a thriller, don't make an action movie, unless you're going to deliberately make it crap.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure it's short. Don't go for the epic, you know, two-hour film. Between 70 and 90 minutes should be your target range. And that's it. That's the two rules, really.
No, the rules.
They're the rules, really. I think when someone's saying, what shall I make as a short film? That's what I would... as a feature film, that's what I would say. Don't try and copy Hollywood and make it nice and short.
Something like, there's Jesus in my garden.
Yeah, exactly.
The new Jesus in my garden.
Yeah. It's
outdoors.
Or a horror, maybe a Christian horror film would be the ultimate winner, really.
Oh, Jesus comes to save the day.
I have to be careful here because my sister is a vicar, so I don't want to get in trouble with my sister. Joking aside, a Christian horror film would probably have an enormous market.
Yeah.
Did you also know, interestingly, that men and women go to see horror equally? You'd think it'd be more of a boys' thing, wouldn't you?
No, a lot of girls like horror films.
Yeah, and do you know what, part of the reason they reckon is because it's a really good date film, because you're going to end up like holding on to each other.
Ah.
And also, people over 30 generally don't go and see horror films, and this is to do with pushing boundaries. So young people like to push their boundaries as they until they get to about 30, because your brain fuses between the age of 25 and 30, apparently. So, horror
my
order.
My brain stopped.
So you know when people say, oh, I feel like I'm still 27?
Yeah.
It's because it's that's the apparently the time at which your brain stops growing. I've heard. I mean, it's yeah, complete
I
used rubbish.
To say it was late. I read somewhere it was your brain. It's in your early 20s. It's still forming.
Which is why Jimmy Savile dressed the way he did, you know, because he obviously still thought he was, you know, 27.
Yes, that's why people always dress the same age as 27.
Yeah.
But then when is the transition to what I want to know, when old people wear beige?
Oh, and zip up cardies and comfortable shoes.
I've wear comfortable shoes, but
yeah.
I the beige thing, you've got your, I don't even know what they are, Bruce, some weird sandals. But when, because I thought, oh, beige is going to die out, but, you know, when I was 20, I thought, this must just be the generation my grandparents won't, you know, that, and now beige is, there's still a lot of beige.
Light brown chinos. Yeah, I know where you live in the Isle of Wight. Bembridge is it's quite a well known retirement area.
Yeah,
and Brexit stronghold.
You get to see the full.
And that is, you know, it is very 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 beige there. Yeah, yeah.
You go into a charity shop and they're closed 90. I mean,
in fact, the whole everything, but even the ornaments tend to be a lighter brown, maybe colour.
Yeah, what
maybe,
is that?
Maybe it is because those people grew up in the 50s, and maybe because of the Second World War, all the colour had gone out of the world. And stuff, maybe there wasn't colour dye.
Yeah.
And they're just used to a light. And maybe everything was khaki because it was all army surplus.
So I don't want there to be a time that when old people stop wearing ties and they start wearing tracksuits and it won't be. If beige disappears.
That is the weird thing now when you do see old ladies covered in tattoos. That is odd. That's going to be the new generation, isn't it? They're going to have, like, you know, the new generation are going to have what they're called. I don't want to say it because it's probably not politically correct, but yeah, dodgy tattoos.
Yeah,
and be wearing and have those strange earrings that stretch your ears out.
The post stretchy ear things are one of the worst things. So having some sort of pink spaghetti hanging off your head.
So yeah, you're gonna, there'll be a whole generation of people dressed like Amy Winehouse with lots of tattoos. That's gonna be weird, isn't it?
Approximately 20 years time, the tattoo removing business, I'll start investing in it now, will be earning, it'll make tons of money.
Have you got a tattoo?
No.
I've got one.
Oh, you've got one homemade one?
An accident, yeah. It was in my A-level design exam. I accidentally stabbed myself with a pen.
This is what people used to make at school. It's called a Pompey dot or something, or whatever, where you put ink on your compass and drive it deep into your skin to make the fountain pen.
Do you know what the tears mean? Do you know what the tears mean?
You kill someone, isn't it?
No, it's quite sad, really. It's each year you're in Borstal, is a tear.
I thought it was that you killed someone.
No, I think it's for, and the bird on your hand, isn't that to say you've done time? I'm making these up now. I know an anchor was, if you have an anchor on your arm, it meant that you were Christian because it was a cross. But you do it as an anchor, so you would cover up the fact that you were Christian in case someone who was non-Christian captured you back in the day.
This is good facts here.
Nothing to do with filmmaking.
What else are the main things that you teach these young film students then, apart from story and
I think the fundamentals of where to put the camera from the film business point of view, it's all quite boring and dry, basically. You know, you've got to think about your audience, you've got to think who you're going to sell it to, you've got to think about your story, you're going to try and do something really unique that Hollywood hasn't done.
Mm-hmm.
That's why comedy is great, because Hollywood, anyone can do comedy in any format. So that all that business side of stuff is probably quite obvious, but a lot of people don't think about it when they're making films. And then for the directing point of view, it's really about where you put the camera and how you film it and not to cross the line. And really, do you need a tracking shot? Is a tracking shot you're just doing it because you want to move the camera, or is it a necessary thing?
Yeah, crossing the line, if people don't know, is a famous thing where if you're filming two people, you need to almost draw a line straight down the middle of the scene. And you're shooting, you don't cross that line, because otherwise it looks like people
it's about eye lines.
Like people talking to each other in the same direction, so you're always shooting.
Yeah, it's about, when you see it when it's wrong, it's quite amusing. But also, someone said to me years ago, you know, you're constructing realism. I think it was part of my degree, actually. I think it was Robert Fiske that said that, actually. You're constructing realism, and to construct realism, you have to stick to certain rules. So you haven't explained to students that you can't just put the camera wherever you want. But also think about why you're moving the camera. Like, you know, Steven Spielberg was the master of, and so was Hitchcock, the master of the tracking shot. But they were done for a reason. They weren't just done because they were like, oh, I'll just do a tracking shot. They were tracking with the camera to try and get lots of different shots in. So ultimately, you've got an effective tracking shot would be a shot that gets a wide shot, a mid shot, and a close up all in one. And the show I've just been working on in Ireland, geez, the operators on that show are unbelievable. So skilled at being able to move the camera and get as many shots within a scene, you know, to get as much coverage as possible.
So then with low budget filmmakers, the camera I've got, which I'm hoping to film, which is the watch, basically what I'm doing is I've bought the kit I've accrued. I'm going to use that to film on. So none of the money goes on the kit that's already there.
Yeah. Good lenses.
Lens. I've got a GH5, which is one of these cameras where they think called IBIS, called in body in stabilization, which means that it's almost as good as almost as good as gimbals now.
Mm-hmm.
And gimbals are the new things they have. So we used to have Steadicam first of all, and they just things you
the Movi is used a lot now. But actually, do you know what, if I'm tracking with someone, if I'm going down a corridor following someone, I actually want it handheld.
Yeah,
I don't want it smooth like a scene from The Shining. I want it if it's drama, I want it to be bouncing around the place. And see, I think you can use them in the wrong context sometimes, you know. And actually, you know, but you know, yeah, but each director's different. I know that I worked on a TV show, I won't name it, but I was pretty much fired because I kept on doing handheld stuff, and the rule was on this particular soap opera you couldn't do handheld.
Mad Men.
No. there are certain shows where they say they will never do handheld, and I just think I'm from the Ken Loach school of filmmaking. Ken Loach hasn't used a dolly or a track or a crane in 25 years. Yeah, he's the most selected filmmaker at Cannes, and his last film made a hell of a lot of money, Daniel Blake. And as far as he says, it's about the actors. You know, it's about the story. It's not about movies. It's not about the camera. Now there's camera people all over the place, including my friend Una, who shot Social Suicide. His dad is incidentally Chris Menges, who shot Kez. And they completely disagree. You know, they think it's about the story, but it's also about getting that camera moving. So it depends which school of thought you come from.
You can't please all the people all the time, Bruce.
No, you can't. They can't. No.
I mean, there's definitely going to be no dolly shots in my film.
No, but I mean,
you may put the camera on a skateboard and wheel that backwards.
Skateboards aren't that good. I tell you what, wheelchairs though, amazing. Gently let the tires of a wheelchair down ever so slightly. That makes the best tracking vehicle ever.
And there's loads of wheelchairs on the Isle of Wight.
Yeah, that's one thing we're not short of.
Yeah, we'll be able to nick one of those outside.
So you're going to shoot this on the Isle of Wight, aren't you?
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay.
Because you've got.
And can you tell me how long the script is at the moment?
Well, I've planned. I've almost got it out. I've written 10 pages of it.
10 pages.
I need to do another 80 pages.
10%.
Yeah.
And is it good? I've looked forward to reading.
It's a comedy. I'll tell you more about it.
After this interview.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that'll be enough for now, Bruce. That's great. I'll probably speak to you again at some point. If that's all right.
Yeah. 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 Okay.
What's your? Are you on social media and all that stuff? Or what?
I am on social media. I've just discovered it, Instagram, and discovered how you got to be careful what you put on it. I went to a party in Bembridge on Saturday night.
Yeah,
there was a Swedish party, and there was a hot tub, and my mate Anders, and JC Abrams, I think you know the Abrams. I took a photo of him in the hot tub in his underpants, and as a joke, I tagged Swingers Party on my Instagram page. I'm now being followed by swingers clubs around the world.
Oh, fantastic!
So, Spanish, Italian. So yeah, so I'm on Instagram, even though I don't quite know how to use it. And Facebook, I was a big Facebooker. I just moan about Donald Trump on Facebook.
Are you on Twitter as well?
I am on Twitter. Yeah, yeah. And then I just use that to moan about the Conservatives and Donald Trump.
Bruce Webb?
Bruce Webb 2005, I think, pretty much always.
When you were born?
Yeah, absolutely. Incidentally, I am friends with all the Bruce Webbs in the world, and we all look like each other. It's really odd. They mainly seem to be fishermen on the coast of America, but I've noticed that several of my friends have become friends with the Bruce Webb, who's an Alaskan fisherman, who happens to look a lot like me. So if you are going on any of these social media accounts, just make sure it's the right Bruce Webb, because you might end up becoming friends with the fisherman. Not there's anything wrong with that.
Bruce Webb 2005.
Five.
Is that for all of them?
I think so, yeah.
And your film, I'll put a link to your film on my on the Marit Makes a Movie Facebook page, so you can go and buy it on Amazon and watch it and enjoy it like I did.
I can give you both the links, actually. There's another film, Social Suicide and Be All and End All, and then there's a short film that's up there for free as well. So yeah,
I'll put it on there so you can have a look. Well, thank you so much for your time, Bruce. It's been great.
It's been a pleasure. I wish you all the luck of the world with this film.
Thanks, dude. All right, I need to get a tagline for finishing it. It was Stay Hygienic last time.
I mean, yeah, the one whose was That's All Folks? Was that
yeah, you can't use that. Really.
No, but who actually? Which company came up with that?
It was Warner Brothers, wasn't it?
Was it Warner Brothers?
The Looney Tunes part of Warner Brothers.
You need to have a sign off. Happy shooting.
Well, that sounds like that could be some really horrific massacre, couldn't it?
Yeah,
get traced back to this. And then I get called in saying, oh, I listened to this podcast at the end, did Happy Shooting. I went and killed about 8,000 people.
I knew it,
yeah.
I was so influenced by the podcast.
Okay, it's going to be this. Okay, good luck, and don't kill people.
Yeah, happy shooting, but not guns.
Yeah, that's it. All right, thanks, bye.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.